It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, we'll hear how Medicare may ban doctors who prescribe drugs irresponsibly.
First, hedge funds have been popular money-making options among wealthy investors since the early 90s. And these funds have received media attention in recent years for automating trades and affecting markets by buying and selling large numbers of stocks in seconds or less.
In a frontline investigation that airs tonight at 9 on your local PBS station, producer Martin Smith looks at another side of the hedge fund industry, the rampant insider trading that can take place inside of these companies.
Smith investigates the hedge fund SAC Capital, a very successful firm headed by a single man that was recently indicted by the federal government. The company, to be clear, was indicted and not the man. Martin Smith joins us now to share his investigation. He has been a frontline producer for 28 years and has covered the Iraq War and the 2008 financial crisis. Martin, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
So how common is insider trading in hedge funds and on Wall Street?
That's an excellent question. The FBI began their investigation about 7 years ago into insider trading in hedge funds and quickly realized that they, as one FBI agent put it, quoting Jaws, the movie, "We need a bigger boat." And they got busy in convincing a judge to allow them to install wiretaps on the phones of some traders that they suspected were engaged in insider trading. And they started to get a real cornucopia of information. And that eventually led through the Raj Rajaratnam Galleon case, where Raj Rajaratnam, the head of that firm, got 11 years in prison, and they're closing in on some other traders now at SAC Capital.
There seems to be some fuzzy understanding amongst the people who are on Wall Street and in the hedge fund business about exactly what insider trading is. Could you talk about the letter of the law and then also how it might be interpreted, you know, on the street among these people who are actually trading?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of people on the street that want to say that it's vague. Our investigation, our conversations with prosecutors, and even a lot of hedge fund managers, they told us that it's not vague. When you're talking about proprietary information that's coming from inside a publicly traded company, that is information that is going to move a stock, such as the announcement of a merger or the announcement of a successful drug trial, if you're talking about a pharmaceutical company, or if you're talking about an upgrade or downgrade of a stock, and that information is coming from inside the company and is not publicly known, if you're getting that in advance of it being released, that is insider information. And if you trade on it, you've violated the law. It's that simple. It's not really vague.
And the case that some of the folks you talk to make is that in the phone calls, the number of phone calls that go out there, information gathering phone calls, getting the edge on information, in a way it sounds almost inevitable that something is going to happen.
Well, there were these expert networks that have grown up in the last 10 or so years to play a pretty major role in helping portfolio managers get information about sectors, industry sectors, or even specific companies. And in this process, some of these expert networks would connect portfolio managers with people inside publicly traded companies, and then it was inevitable that some information would get transferred that was then traded on, and that's what the wiretaps show, that there was activity there that was illegal.
Now, your documentary looks at the hedge fund SAC Capital in particular. Now, this group is a giant. Fill us in on SAC and their profile in the industry.
Yeah, SAC stands for Stephen A. Cohen. He founded the fund in 1992. And in the 90s, Cohen was a pioneer of the hedge fund industry, really transforming the industry from what used to be a kind of sleepy area on Wall Street where you would park your money in order to hedge your general portfolio against the risk that you might have if you were invested in too much of one thing or another. What happened with Cohen and a few others that came bursting into the scene in the 90s is that they had hot hands, and they were able to make huge returns for their investors. And so Cohen, his company starts in 1992 and all the way up until just recently, when now it's essentially being shut down by the federal government, they had maybe one bad year, and that was the 2008 disaster. He made it through the dot-com collapse just fine. He had, for many years running, he was returning to his investors something like an average of 30% a year, and that was after taking a 50% cut in their profits and charging his investors a 3% management fee. So he was having to make somewhere north of 60% a year to maintain those returns. It was quite stunning. How did he do it? That's the question.
And, of course, everybody wanted in on this when you've got a company that's outperforming the stock market year after year. Is that when the flag started to be raised?
Well, it's not enough to say that the flags were raised just because he had stellar returns. But that certainly got people paying attention. And the word on Wall Street was, if you talk to traders and ask them, was Stephen A. Cohen, was SAC Capital, were they cheating? They basically said, of course he's cheating. Nobody can make those kinds of returns year after year after year. Now, it's one thing to suspect that, to conclude that, and another one to prove it. So it wasn't until some people started to be indicted in some other hedge fund cases that the government was looking at that these people turned around and said, you know, you really ought to start looking at Stephen Cohen. And as the FBI went forward with their investigations, more and more people pointed towards SAC as a real culprit. And that's where the focus, that's why the focus really landed on them.
Now let's talk about Stephen Cohen, because he's the driving force behind SAC, a company that bears his name. What was he like when he started out, and how did he build this sort of hedge fund empire?
Well, you know, he grew up on Long Island, then he went off to Wharton Business School, and he had a reputation way back then as somebody who had a particular talent in what's called tape reading, which is looking at the ticker and discerning patterns, discerning trends, and making successful trades. There's no doubt that Stephen Cohen was a brilliant trader. He worked for a number of years with a small firm called Gruntel that had some regulatory issues at the time. But when he left there in 92, with his own money, he'd made several million dollars on his own by then. He started trading, and what was interesting about him is he was willing to pay really high commissions to the brokers that placed the trades for his funds. And in turn, he would get what's called in the business a first call. In other words, you know, you scratch my back by paying me high commissions, I'll call you first when I hear a good rumor or have some information that might help you make a little bit more money. Now, some of that information could have been illegal. Most likely, if you're willing to pay very top dollar commissions, you're not doing it for nothing. You're not doing it unless you're getting something for it. So that was an early warning signal that went up that something was going on at SAC. And, you know, that was just the beginning.
Is SAC unique in sort of the extent of the knowledge that flowed through it? Some of it obviously illegal, some of it maybe on the border. Was that unique for a hedge fund?
Well, I think you have to reverse engineer that one a little bit. If the returns are so stellar year after year after year, you have to ask yourself, why do they have an informational edge on the other funds? Why are they able to successfully call the shots time and time again? And so that was a question the Fed started asking, and then when they were pointed.
And it sounds like we lost Martin. We'll get him back. We are talking now with Martin Smith. He is a Frontline producer, and we're talking about the new documentary Frontline is airing tonight on public television here in Wisconsin. It's called To Catch a Traitor.
We'll pick up that conversation after this look at headlines with Kristen Durst.
We're back now with Frontline producer Martin Smith about his the new documentary on Frontline, To Catch a Traitor. Martin, it's good to have you back with us again.
Sorry, I fell off the line there. I don't know what happened.
Well, we've got you back. That's what's important. I want to talk about how insider trading became so rampant at SAC. And I imagine that when you're hot, people want to get on board with you. You've got an operation going and you've got your reputation. Is that how it starts?
Well, yeah, people pile in, and he's charging enormous fees to the clients, and they still want in because even after those extraordinary fees, I mean, again, 50% of profits are handed back to Stephen Cohen. Only half of what he makes on your behalf do you get to keep. But people still kept piling in, and so they continue to have hot hand year after year after year. Now, there becomes tremendous pressure on the traders on the floor at SAC Capital, and that's about 1,000 people, 1,000 employees, and many of them portfolio managers there. They have a great deal of incentive to develop every edge possible that they can. Now, what the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission in Washington, has charged Stephen Cohen with is failure to supervise. They have not charged him with a crime. They have charged the company, SAC, they've indicted it as a criminal operation. But so far, nobody's able to make a criminal charge stick to Stephen Cohen himself, but it's clear that within the company, SAC, there was a lot of insider trading going on.
Do you expect there to be charges brought against Stephen? Is this something that's in the works, or is there a reason that he's not been charged?
Well, there's two possibilities there, I think. One is that he was able to avoid making a phone call or writing a text or an email and said, boy, this is great insider information, thanks a lot. He didn't leave those kinds of tracks. Or the other possibility is that he simply was willfully blind, let the traders do what they were doing, whatever that might be, and was, instructed them not to let him know exactly what was going on. Because, there's 7 traders so far. One has been tried by a jury, and 6 others have pled guilty. And another one has gone to trial, an 8th. The trial began today. And the fellow today was involved in a trade that is, according to the U.S. attorney, the largest insider trade in history. It netted $276 million for SAC Capital. And Cohen was aware of that trade. What the company is saying is that they made the trade not based on the insider information that they had, but on some other information that they got that wasn't proprietary.
There's a scene in the documentary where I believe it's Cohen who's being depositioned himself, and he's asked, do you know what 10B is, what this insider trading law is? And he says, no, it's kind of fuzzy to me exactly what that's saying. Do you buy that?
Extraordinary. It's extraordinary. No. I mean, look, he knows what the laws are. He has to know what those laws are. Now, his lawyers may have told him for that deposition to be a bit squirrely and vague about it, as if the laws are vague. They're not. He knows that. And so it's extraordinary piece of exclusive footage that is in the documentary tonight. This deposition has not been seen until it was leaked to us by an anonymous source. And it is really remarkable that he makes those claims that the law is fuzzy and whatnot. The law is not so fuzzy.
What does that have to say about insider trading? I mean, is that an argument that could be commonly made on Wall Street and in hedge funds, that the law is funny? Is this kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card for people to use?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's convenient for them to say that it's fuzzy. It gives them a sort of a wiggle room, or they attempt to create a wiggle room there. In a lot of industries in America, when it deals with food, the food industry or with safety issues in factories, if you're negligent in maintaining diligence over your operation, you can be charged with criminal negligence. In finance, there is no corollary to criminal negligence. They don't say you can't prove fraud in finance in the same way. The fact is that someone like Cohen, he's in charge of the company, and it's his responsibility to be diligent and to be on top of what his traders are doing. This is not a victimless crime. People get hurt, and he's responsible. But as it is, only a civil charge has been filed against him. But you're absolutely right. This gives them a kind of, I mean, they're trying to create some space here to say, well, it's vague, we didn't, you know, really know. But I'm sorry, it's his responsibility to know what's going on.
I want to go back and talk a little bit about the expert networks, and this is part and parcel of the hedge fund business, and yet it's pretty extraordinary. Now, there is a fuzzy line about what sort of information is above board and what kind of information is insider trading. How would you explain how those expert networks work?
Well, I think of them as something like matchmakers and almost like something like an escort service whereby, you know, you call up and you call up the expert network and say you want to be put on the phone with somebody inside a certain company that has some inside information, you know, knows what's going on in that. Well, the expert network itself will make that connection for you, but they're not in the room when you're making that phone call, so they don't know what's going on. And some like an escort service, they don't really know what's going on between the consultant that they've put the hedge fund manager in touch with. So there was bound to be abuse. These expert networks serve a useful role in the industry. It's not by any means all of them doing illegal matchmaking, but it's inevitable with the money involved that there would be insider information passed. There's no reason for the hedge fund managers to want to pay top dollar, thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars to these networks if they weren't getting useful information.
It seems pretty seductive on both ends. You profile a woman named Winnie who was given, you know, gift certificates worth hundreds of dollars and live lobsters just to keep the information coming.
Plus $200,000 or so that she made giving information. But she wrote to one of the traders at SAC Capital that she needed a little more sugar. In other words, she wanted some favors, some gifts. And so the trader at SAC asked his assistant to get her a gift certificate to an upscale boutique. And she sent it back. She says, I don't want that. I want a $500 gift certificate to Cheesecake Factory, and I need some live lobsters. Well,
she knew what she wanted.
She knew what she wanted, and she got what she wanted.
It's kind of extraordinary. I mean, having investigated this, you can see that the situation you just described, where a hedge fund wants information so that it can make informed trades for its shareholders or for the people it's managing their money for, and then the people who are providing that information, it's got to be a very difficult line to walk sometimes. Do you think that there needs to be more regulation?
I think what's happening right now is you're seeing the Securities and Exchange Commission and the FBI are becoming more sophisticated, and there are computer programs that allow them to match the timing of trades with the timing of certain phone calls or certain texts or certain emails that can map a lot of this activity. And these are programs that didn't exist just a few years ago, and they're using these things very effectively. These investigations of the hedge fund industry began many years ago when the FBI was looking at these pump-and-dump schemes, what's profiled in The Wolf of Wall Street, the new Martin Scorsese film. These are, you know, thinly traded stocks that guys go in and they pump them up, or they drive the price down with rumors about failures of this or that, and they make a lot of money that way. Well, these pump-and-dumpers said to the FBI back in the mid-2000s, says, you know, you shouldn't be looking at us. You should look at the big boys on Wall Street, the dudes that are running the hedge funds. Those are the guys you want to go after. And that's when they realized that there was a lot more corruption at much higher levels than they had suspected.
Martin, does the SEC have a handle on this now?
I don't know if the SEC has a handle on it, but certainly they set a very low bar for themselves, given that the Madoff affair happened right under their nose and they missed every signal that could have alerted them to, you know, what was going on there. So, yes, they've come a long way since then, but as I said, that's a low bar. They're under new management. I think they're doing a better job. I think the problem here is that we don't know how widespread this is.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Martin, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Frontline producer Martin Smith about their new documentary, To Catch a Traitor.
And you can see that tonight at 9 on your local PBS station. Coming up, we'll be back with news on a potential movement by Medicare to crack down on doctors who prescribe drugs irresponsibly. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at sleep deprivation and the adverse effects it can have on the body and the mind.
First, we take a look at a proposed change to Medicare that would beef up oversight for prescription drugs. Program officials are seeking new powers to better control and potentially bar doctors engaged in fraudulent or harmful prescribing.
And our next guest says it's a dramatic departure for the agency, which historically has been given much higher priority to making medications easily accessible to seniors and the disabled than to weeding out dangerous providers of health care. Joining us now is Charles Ornstein, senior healthcare reporter at ProPublica. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be back.
Well, I'm wondering, why is this happening now? Was there a perceived problem that they're trying to fix?
Well, we've been reporting at ProPublica about serious problems in Medicare's oversight of its prescription drug program, which is known as Part D, for many months. We found doctors who prescribed large quantities of risky and inappropriate medications to patients. We found doctors who were prescribing with an extensive dedication to brand name drugs when generics were widely available. And we found doctors whose prescribing patterns suggested that fraud was taking place with their provider IDs, either with their knowledge or without their knowledge. And I think that what we showed was that Medicare has the ability to track a whole lot. They fill one out of every four prescriptions in the country. They cover those, but they weren't doing much to track these sort of issues. So by bringing these issues to light, I think that they now realize they need to do more in this regard.
And with this fraudulent prescribing, is this in some cases doctors making money on the deal, or you mentioned without their knowledge, fraudsters using a doctor's identity to make money by getting these prescriptions?
Well, we've seen examples of both. We've talked to doctors who literally overnight went from having $200,000 in prescriptions attributed to them one year to having $4 million attributed to them the next, who said that they didn't know anything about this, and nobody from Medicare called to ask questions, that their provider identification numbers must have been stolen by somebody and used for drugs which they don't routinely prescribe to their patients. We talked to doctors who saw their prescriptions increase from $2 million a year to $8 million a year. And again, Medicare didn't ask questions. At the same time, we saw examples of physicians and podiatrists that were actively taking kickbacks from pharmacy chains and were convicted or pleaded guilty to charges of accepting kickbacks in exchange for writing prescriptions that were never dispensed but were charged to the Medicare Part D program.
So to enforce this now, what is new that we're hearing from Medicare this week?
Well, there's a couple major new developments. The first is that Medicare is planning to require that any physician who writes a prescription to a patient who's in Medicare Part D, so there's 36 million people, seniors and the disabled, who are in Medicare Part D, they would actually have to be enrolled in the Medicare program. Until now, any licensed provider could write a prescription to a patient in Medicare, and Medicare would fill that, but would have no way of even knowing who they were or if they had action taken against their licenses, that sort of thing. So going forward, Medicare intends to require that physicians who prescribe drugs to patients in the program actually have to be Medicare providers. The second thing is that they are giving themselves additional authority to kick doctors out of the Medicare program if their prescribing patterns appear dangerous or harmful or fraudulent. And so this could mean that they've had action taken against their medical license, a suspension or revocation in any state, if they're licensed in more than one state, for example, or they've had action taken against them by the DEA, or just if Medicare examines their prescribing patterns and trends and finds that they're aberrant or very, very different from their peers. We're not talking about people who are slightly different or who are, you know, just a little bit off. I mean, these are people who are dramatically off, who are prescribing reams of medications that may be inappropriate or harmful or fraudulent to patients.
We're talking orders of magnitude more, it sounds like, not just
Absolutely.
A little bit more here and there.
For sure.
Is there a concern that these enforcement measures might make it more difficult for some people who need medications to get them from the doctors they go to if they get caught up in this umbrella of enforcement?
So the Medicare has issued this as what's called a proposed rule. So that's their standard way of making big changes to the program. So people have an opportunity to comment on it before it goes into effect. But to your question, undoubtedly there will be changes because beginning in January of 2015, assuming this goes into effect as proposed, people who see doctors that are not Medicare providers will either have to have their doctors enroll in Medicare or seek an exception, or they'll have to find a new doctor. But at the same time, you have to think about this from the perspective of patient protection. So just allowing patients to get whatever drugs they want when they want them from any doctor willing to prescribe them may not be in their best interest. And it, in fact, may be in their interest to ensure that there's a consistent level of quality or at least a minimum standard of quality for those prescribers.
Do we have a sense of how much this has been costing Medicare and, I guess, by extension, us?
Right. So the Medicare Part D program costs taxpayers in excess of $60 billion a year. And particularly in cases in which doctors are heavy brand name prescribers, an individual doctor alone can account for as much as $10 million in prescribing in the program. So just making small differences and weeding out prescribers who are vastly different from their peers or who are prescribing in harmful or fraudulent ways can both save the program money but also protect beneficiaries who, you know, may be getting medications that addict them, may be getting medications that endanger their lives, or may just be getting medications that sedate them and put them in chemical comas when those medications may not be appropriate.
So not just costly here, but potentially dangerous for some people.
Unquestionably.
You also, I think, talked to some experts who suggested changes that weren't brought out this week by Medicare. What are some of the other ideas out there when it comes to fighting fraud in Medicare prescriptions?
Well, I think that one of the suggestions that we heard was that doctors should be required to write the diagnosis that they give to a patient on a prescription to ensure that as a pharmacy fills it and as insurance companies pay for it, that there's legitimate reasons that patients are getting prescriptions. And while doctors are certainly entitled to write prescriptions for indications that are not approved by the FDA, and this is a pretty common practice, in fact, there are some things like prescribing Alzheimer's medications to people who have autism, which don't have published research that supports their use, but yet we found an example of a physician who regularly does that. So by being able to understand what doctors are prescribing drugs for, you may be able to have conversations with those physicians or otherwise intervene if there's appears to be an indication of an inappropriate usage. Another one is to match the information that Medicare has in terms of which doctors patients see to information on prescriptions. So if a patient is getting prescriptions from a doctor who is not billing for treating them or in a different city, it may be an indication that Medicare should be asking questions, either because there could be evidence of fraud or that, you know, there may just be inappropriate prescribing or pill mills that are going on that Medicare may be interested in looking at.
So what you've talked about so far that Medicare actually is doing is requiring doctors to be registered with Medicare for Medicare to cover their prescriptions and having the ability to bump doctors out of Medicare for a variety of reasons, fraud, dangerous prescribing. Anything else in the new regulations that is noteworthy?
Yes. I mean, they also plan to change the list of drugs that have requirement that insurers have to cover all the drugs in the class. So these are what are called protected drug classes, and they're intended for drugs that are extremely important for patients and that restrictions that are imposed by insurance companies could harm their ability to access life-saving and very needed medications. But as Medicare has reevaluated this list, they've determined that not all the medications that are currently on the list, for example, antidepressants, need to be on the list. So according to their plan, some of those may be coming off in 2015. That's one thing to look out for.
That would not be all antidepressants. That would be some antidepressants.
It would basically give insurance companies the ability to set their own formularies from insurance company to insurance company, and also to impose some restrictions. So, for example, on newer antidepressants that would require that are very expensive, that it would permit insurance companies to make their patients perhaps try a generic first or obtain prior approval before they're able to get that medication. So it wouldn't take these medications away from patients. It wouldn't prevent patients from getting them. And in fact, some insurers may decide that they don't want to impose restrictions, but it would give insurance companies more ability to set requirements for coverage in these classes as they would, say, for a cholesterol drug.
So Medicare has floated these changes now. If all holds as it is, when would they go into effect?
So right now they're seeking comments from individuals about the changes, and they would go into effect beginning on January 1st of 2015.
Charles, thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me back.
That's Charles Ornstein. He's senior healthcare reporter for ProPublica.
Let's be honest here. How do you feel after a night of little or no sleep? Probably not very good, but what if you tried to go days without sleep?
As a teenager, our next guest tried doing just that, and he recently wrote about his experience. And in addition to the adverse health effects of sleeplessness, he says sleep deprivation is like torture. In some cases, sleep deprivation has actually been used as a form of torture.
Joining us now is Seth Maxon. He's a journalist, and his recent piece, How Sleep Deprivation Decays the Mind and Body, appeared in The Atlantic. We've got a link to it on the Central Time Facebook page. Seth, welcome to the show.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks.
So after all this time, we still don't fully understand why people need to sleep, and it seems like sleep deprivation is just about as misunderstood as sleep itself. Why is that?
Well, I can't really say why exactly, but you know, it's hard to say. You know, things like eating and breathing, it's a lot easier to tell exactly what function those processes serve. You know, we can see food providing our blood nutrients. We can see that our lungs need air to breathe. But with sleep, it's harder to tell exactly what's going on in the body and why exactly we need to do it.
Now, you had a personal experience with this. You were in high school, and you tried to go for days without sleep. Can you talk about why you did that and what happened?
Sure. So while I was a teenager, you know, I started thinking for the first time about how, you know, life is short, and it's a pretty precious thing. And I got to thinking that, you know, sleeping one third of each day, that just didn't seem like a very efficient use of a short period of time. And that bothered me. And I kind of thought, you know, one day I'm going to see how long I can go without sleeping and see what I can accomplish in that time. So one day while I was actually on a school trip, in Europe, and I just decided to go for it. And, I had pretty terrible consequences. I kind of lost it a little, started behaving very bizarrely. And I had, adverse physical consequences as well. And I wound up in the hospital.
And it wasn't an easy ride even from then. You couldn't convince them, I guess, at the time that, okay, just need a little bit of shut-eye and then I'll be okay. I mean, we're talking about 4 months of medications to get you on your feet again.
That's right. And, you know, I think that kind of speaks to how serious, you know, sleep deprivation can be. You know, I was having hallucinations. I was, you know, behaving really bizarrely, and the doctors in the hospital at the time thought I had taken a lot of drugs, which I had not. You know, I had to, it took a long time to wean off all the medication that I was given as soon as I arrived at the hospital.
Do you remember specifically what it felt like inside your head going that long without sleep?
It was, you know, just physically, it was definitely kind of painful. I had, you know, kind of a just persistent ache in my head. In terms of emotionally, it was very strange. You know, it wasn't just about, you know, being exhausted and having difficulty concentrating, although I certainly did have those feelings. You know, I was making strange connections. I was coming up with theories left and right. Like I said, I was hallucinating voices a little bit, and it was, you know, in retrospect, it was very scary.
So is it possible when we are sleep deprived chronically or like you were for a period of days, I guess, what do we know about the damage we're doing to ourselves?
Well, there are a lot of several studies have come out to show all sorts of damage that can be done. You know, the experts that I spoke with and the studies I looked at said that sleep deprivation and chronic sleep loss, that's sleep loss on a regular basis, can lead to problems, can lead to heart problems, hypertension. It can, you know, affect your immune system. It can lead to weight gain, depression. It's been linked to. There's even one study that has shown chronic loss of sleep being linked to higher rates of mortality. So the consequences, though not universally agreed upon, are when you start to read about them and talk to experts about them, reveal themselves to be quite severe.
Is it possible for sleep deprivation to actually kill us?
Yes, actually. You know, sleep deprivation, it can cause hypothermia, it can cause severe brain damage, and you know, there have been some studies that have, well, first of all, there have been some people in the real world who have died of sleep deprivation. During the Euro Cup in 2012, there was a Chinese soccer fan who tried to stay up all night every night so he wouldn't miss a minute of the Euro Cup, and he wound up dying after staying awake for 11 days. Just this past summer, a young intern at Bank of America stayed up for 3 straight days and died after only three days of sleep deprivation.
Okay, so you got to ask, what is going on in our bodies? I mean, you've talked about some of the things that can happen that will tip us off balance, some high blood pressure and depression-like symptoms, heart symptoms. But, you know, when an autopsy is done, do we know? Can we finger the culprit?
You know, I can't say for sure, but I'm not an expert, but, you know, what effects of sleep deprivation ultimately can kill somebody are disputed. There's a study on rats that was done where, you know, all of these things, such as hypothermia or severe brain damage, were discussed. And, you know, experts dispute what ultimately kills a person.
Now, there was an intriguing aspect in your article. Apparently, there's something in the blood called the S substance. I guess we don't know quite what it is, but when we sleep, we get rid of it. What is the S substance as we know about it?
Right. So what sleep experts have seen is that the longer and longer a person stays awake, the blood gets clogged with this substance that they refer to as substance S. And there are a lot of people who believe it to be adenosine, which is a byproduct of energy production. And, you know, the only way to clear the blood of this substance that clogs it up is to sleep. So, you know, that's very interesting to a lot of researchers, and they think finding out exactly what it is might be the key to understanding why people need to sleep.
Now, sleep deprivation has also been used, and we can start to see why as we talk here. It's been used as a form of torture, both in the Soviet Gulag and closer to home, I guess. We've been using it sometimes in Guantanamo. Why is sleep deprivation such effective torture?
Well, sleep deprivation is seen as a useful form of torture because interrogators see it as a way to break a prisoner's will to defy them. They see it as a useful way to break a prisoner's will to resist coercion as well. So they think it makes them more susceptible to coercion and more likely to confess. or speak up or implicate others.
So for those of us who are listening to this and feeling alarmed about how much sleep we actually need, how much sleep do we need to be at our best and to kind of keep at bay some of the repercussions that can come up in terms of our health?
Well, the studies that I looked at and the experts I spoke to said that on average, most people need about 7 1/4 hours of sleep a night. The studies have shown that, you know, the people that get 7 1/4 hours of sleep are healthier and sometimes even live longer than those who get less or more.
And can we make it up when we've had a bad couple of nights?
You know, that's a little bit of a misconception, is catching up on sleep. I've done it. I'm sure a lot of people have done it where, you know, you get 4 or 5 hours of sleep and then you say, oh, I'll make up for it on the weekend. But, you know, you can't really do that if you do it on a very regular basis. For instance, if you have a work schedule or any kind of schedule that has you sleeping about 5 or 6 hours of sleep a night during the week, and then you want to make up for that during the weekend, you know, if you do the math, it doesn't quite work out, because you're talking about needing to get 7 hours of sleep just as a baseline of what you need, and then an additional, 10 or 12 extra hours of sleep. And frankly, that's just not going to happen.
All right. So we have to guard this carefully, guard our sleep. Seth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Veronica.
We've been talking to Seth Maxon, a journalist based in New York City. His piece on sleep deprivation recently appeared in The Atlantic.